2005, open public hearings on SB 5513 and 5514.
That was fast. That was like...
On cue? Get those guys.
The House is present.
For important people in the Senate. Yeah.
Who said that? Is that the senator?
That was a, yeah.
I got here at 8:30 and I was the only one here.
We're here waiting for the gavel before it came in.
We could wind it down.
Chancellor, are you ready to start?
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, George Kernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. And we're pleased to be before you again today to wrap up, at least we hope wrap up, phase two of our hearings. You have in your packet this morning responses from a variety of questions that were raised yesterday, and I would commend them to you. If you have any further questions about those things, please don't hesitate to ask. But in the interest of time, I think at this point I would cede some time to Mr. McGee with your indulgence, and he can continue with his report.
Okay. Mr. McGee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. Based on some questions we were getting this week, we thought it would be appropriate to spend a little more time than we would normally do on Package 90 as part of the budget. Package 90 is a policy package, and it generally includes the governor's adjustments to the ongoing budget for the agency. Normally, policy packages include new programs like the K-20 beta system, enhancements such as the increased funding for faculty compensation, new projects like the Bedford facility. But Package 90 generally contains very often reductions to the budget or other kinds of adjustments that the governor's made to really the ongoing programs. In this package, you'll see a reduction of $45 million in general fund, a reduction in other funds limited of $13 million, and an increase in other funds non-limited of $16.7 million. And there really are kind of two categories of adjustments in this budget. The first are changes to the essential budget level, or what used to be referred to as current service level. And higher education, since the Senate Bill 271, the Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act, their budgets are developed somewhat differently than other agencies. Their positions are not included in the DASS's PICS, position control system. So we have to lay in some information in ways we don't with other agencies. And as we developed this budget, there were a number of things in the essential budget level that we felt needed correcting. And in order to allow whatever policy discussion needed to occur in committee, we laid these in Package 90 rather than going back and just making the adjustments in the essential budget level, the base budget and the essential packages. So I wanted to kind of step you through what those adjustments are, and then I'll talk about what the actual program reductions are. There are several essential budget level adjustments. The first was adjusting the general fund, other funds, fund split in the base budget and several of the essential packages. In the last biennium, you approved a fund split of roughly, for the education general programs, about 36.7% general fund, about 63.3% other funds. The essential budget level that was submitted had a higher percentage general fund, about 37.4%. And other funds of 62.6%. Mr. Bender talked to you on the first day, I believe, about the reductions in other funds revenues that the department experienced in this current biennium. Enrollment down, tuition lower than expected, expenditures lower. As a result, when they projected forward, they felt a need to increase their general fund share of their essential budget level. We believe it's appropriate for them to come in at that level with the same fund split that was in the legislatively approved budget, and there are techniques in the budget development process to deal with reductions in other fund revenues. There's a separate package where expenditures are reduced to that, and agencies are allowed then to bring forward a policy package, if need be, for the rest of the general fund. We believe that's the appropriate way of doing that rather than doing the essential budget level. The result here, in essence, was we shifted $11.9 million that was in general fund in the essential budget level back to other funds where we believe it would be appropriate. So that was our first adjustment. The second adjustment was how the pension obligation bonds were allocated within the budget. Those bonds, you recall, were sold in 2003 to fund some of the unfunded liability from the for the PERS system, and those are appropriately charged within an agency against the personal services costs throughout the budget. The agency initially had just charged those against general fund and other funds. We reallocated those to include appropriate charges against other funds, non-limited. The result here was general fund was reduced by $6.2 million, other funds reduced by $9.1 million, other funds, non-limited, increased by $15.3 million. Third adjustment was on the PERS rate itself. The PERS rate that was budgeted in the governor's budget was 15.52%. The agency had somewhat, on the whole, somewhat higher rates in their budget development at this point. We went through those, made the reductions back to the 15.2% that was used for all other agencies. That resulted in reductions of $2.4 million general fund, $15.6 million other funds limited, and $6.8 million other funds non-limited. Then the last essential adjustment to the essential budget level was a reallocation of state government service charges. Those were allocated among general fund, other funds non-limited. When we reviewed those, we believe that a larger percentage of those charges need to be borne by the other funds non-limited piece of the budget, the auxiliary enterprises particularly. And so we made a shift of that reduced general fund by $6.2 million, reduced other funds by $200,000, and increased the other funds non-limited by $6.4 million. Working with the agency after the governor's budget was done, we found we went too far in that, and we are actually asking you as a technical adjustment that I mentioned the other day, essentially to shift $5.2 million other funds non-limited to other funds limited to deal with what was an over-adjustment on our part. So those are the changes in the essential, we call the essential budget level issues. That resulted in general fund reductions of $26.7 million from the essential budget level. And as a result, the essential budget level that's contained in the budget documents we think is overstated by that amount. And so we don't believe that's an appropriate comparison of really kind of previous budgets. Those are kind of the technical issues. There are some program reductions, and Senator Nelson asked about these yesterday, and I wanted to just give you some more information on what those are, and the agency may want to talk to you a little bit more about what the impact is. As I mentioned in my initial presentation, the governor made reductions in all of the resource allocation of the RAM distributions except for the three, the supplemental funding for the small schools, the support for the Cascade campus in Bend, and the funding you approved for the signature research centers dealing with nanotechnology. That resulted in $14 million in general fund reductions. I'll have the detail on those in the next page. We also had reductions in the Agriculture Experiment Station, the Forest Research Laboratory, which totaled $2.6 million. And we proposed to use interest earnings on bond funds to offset some debt service costs. That resulted in a shift of about $1.7 million general fund to other funds non-limited, so saving that general fund amount. Next page shows you where the $14 million in education and general savings come from in terms of the RAM items again. And these would be familiar to you, I think, from as Ms. Pernsteiner mentioned yesterday, would be familiar to you from when you did your priority ranking of this agency's budget, because these are the type of line items that you saw throughout that. So, for example, the governor reduced undergraduate and graduate enrollment-based funding by $6.9 million. Western undergraduate exchange by $26,000, fee remission equity by $26,000, and so on down from here. Chancellor's office, as we talked about, we reduced $4.8 million, which we also believe, in retrospect, that was too large a reduction. But that's the detail on the $14.8 million that you see as reductions in the co-chair's budget display. Finally, I wanted to give you an indication of what the impact of this is on the major and the general fund side on the major operational units. The education in general budget, the agriculture experiment station, the extension of the Forest Research Laboratory, because I know there's been some discussion about the impact, particularly in the extension service, and I wanted to sort of show you how that worked out. This display shows you initially the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget for each of those four units. It shows you the general fund impact of the essential budget level adjustments, the fund split, the PERS rate, the pension obligation bond, state government service charges. And as you'll see, those reduce the education general budget by 4% from 2003-05, the agriculture experiment station by 3.5%, the extension service by 8.1%, and the forest research lab by 4.1%. Obviously, the extension service stands out here, and I think the reason for that particularly is because difficulties that they have had with their non-general fund sources, the federal funds they receive, the other funds they receive, have been in somewhat decline, so there was a larger shift in the initial essential budget level to general fund, in essence an attempt to backfill at that stage. And so you see a larger impact on the extension service as a result of what we believe were technical corrections to the essential budget level than you see on the other operational units here. The program reductions then, going on the next block, the $14 million in education in general reduced that by another 2.5% from the legislatively approved budget. Ag Experiment Station was reduced by 4.7%. We didn't take any additional reductions on the Extension Service because of the impact of the essential budget corrections here. We didn't want to go any further on the general fund side. And the Forest Research Lab was reduced by 5.1%. The total impact, then, of Package 90, not the entire impact of the governor's budget, but just of this one package, then, on the education general budget, reduced that by 6.5%, the Ag Experiment Station by 8.2%, the Extension Service by 8.1%, and the Forest Research Lab by 9.2%. I apologize for this being as technical as it is, but this was the steps we believe were needed to be done to move the governor's budget forward.
Yes. Mr. Bender.
And if I may interject here, Mr. Chair and members, you may note that the both the Senate and House co-chairs had particular items for restoration to the statewide public services, and the amounts that their restorations were based on are based on the reductions row that you see here on page 7 of Mr. McGee's handout. The House co-chair budget had totally restored the reductions that you see there for the Agricultural Experiment Station of $2.3 million and the reduction for the Forest Research Lab of $250,000. The Senate co-chair budget had included a restoration of $1 million for the Agricultural Experiment Station out of the $2.3 million reduction. Neither of those budgets had included any restoration for extension service based on the fact that the actual reduction in excess of the correction of the fund shift amounts, there was none taken for extension service. So that's why the co-chairs' budgets came back the way that they did.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
On this $14 million, then I guess the thought was that the universities would then have to, if they wanted to, make some of this up through the tuition increases. Is that kind of a thought of that?
Mr. Senator Nelson, a portion of this would be made up by tuition increases. A portion would require the universities to take some reductions.
Another follow-up?
Yes, Senator.
Dr. Ray was talking about the three steps of the which would help the universities the most. The tuition freeze he didn't like. That was the worst of the and then the other one was the what was the opportunity grant?
Opportunity grant and enrollment growth funding.
Yeah, and then the top one was enrollment growth funding, and that's what we're talking about here. Enrollment based funding is what we're trying to reduce.
Mr. Senator Nelson, that would be where you would be adding funds for. I would take this opportunity to make a comment. The governor did not fund enrollment growth either for the higher education system or the community colleges. He's concerned with that, but is also concerned about where the funding would come from for a significant increase for either enrollment growth at the higher education or enrollment restoration at community colleges. But were that to happen, he very strongly believes that it should be equitable between both the community colleges and the higher education system. So if we fund enrollment issues at either, we really should be funding both.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. McGee, I think I follow your your computations here. But what I don't, but it's hard for me to accept, is that you accept that that the statewide are going to be reduced at a significantly higher level than the education and general fund. I understand your computations on how you got there, I believe, but I don't understand your logic in accepting that these programs that are so critical to the natural resource-based industries should be funded at that level.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, understand your concerns in putting together his budget in the same very difficult resource environment that you're working to put to your budget together. Looking at his priorities, he was felt that he was unable to fund the state wage at a higher level, and did believe that somewhat higher proportional funding was appropriate for the education general programs. It's a priority issue of dealing with scarce resources at a difficult time.
I can accept that I can accept that we have a difference in priorities, but I certainly have it on the record that those are not my priorities, in that these statewide services have been a integral function of our land grant university system for any number of years, decades, and to continue to defund them, they're reaching a point where they're no longer functional, and that they're by the time that you pay the staff, there's nothing left to do anything. This process, if we continue it, will eliminate our statewides, and to me, that's untenable.
I had a general question, and it's very general. In determining the essential budget level, particularly on the education and general costs, because we fund only a modest portion of the total cost of the university system, we're looking at the essential budget level not in relationship just to our general fund contribution, but to the total funds available to the university, right?
Mr. Chair, we do. The essential budget level is an all funds budget. That's correct.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Going back to what Steve talking about, I mean, so basically out of this budget, and I'm talking on page 7 here, you're basically saying that the essential budget level adjustments have already been taken. Those aren't even on consideration in these budgets, and we're just talking about the third line, the reductions. Am I correct about that?
The essential budget level adjustments are made in the governor's recommended budget to restore or to arrive at apportionment of costs based on how they were apportioned by the legislature in the 2003 legislative session. So these were adjustments that appear because in the original calculation, that's not how they turned out. They turned out with a different apportionment. Now, when you say these are already taken, of course, nothing is really done yet until you approve the budget. So it's just, this is an explanation of how the budget numbers came to be what they are, to the extent that there are budget issues that you wish to address. We will address them in work sessions.
Just to follow up, when I was looking at this other sheet, it's kind of weird. I thought I was only talking about a $14 million reduction in, say, education in general, but really we're talking about a $36 million reduction. Is that
right?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we would not consider the $22 million, in fact, a reduction because we don't believe it should have been there to begin with.
Okay.
We believe it was essentially a fund shift due to declining resources, and it should have been presented as a lower essential budget level and perhaps a policy package asking for some additional general fund to make up for the other funds resources didn't come in this biennium. That's normally the way budgets are developed in that particular problem occurs.
And the Legislative Fiscal Office would concur with that. We think it's very important that when you get a budget, so much of it is based on formulaic roll-ups and calculations before you start looking at particular policy packages. We believe it's very important that the budget that comes back to you reflects the decisions that were made by the prior session. So to the extent that you, this session, want to make changes, you, of course, can do that, but at least you're starting at the place where the legislature left the budget last time, as opposed to there having been some changes before it even gets to you.
I don't want to make this any more confusing, but I understand that the essential budget level adjustments are not, in fact, reductions in the sense that they're fund shifts in many ways. The reductions are actually reductions.
Mm-hmm.
But is the reduction in education in general, the $14 million, is it a reduction that if it wasn't reduced would have been attributed to enrollment growth in the essential budget level, or is it merely just a reduction in current?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question, it is a reduction in the current budget, which doesn't fund enrollment growth. We don't fund enrollment growth within the essential budget level in either higher education or community colleges. So it really is a reduction from the current level of the budget independently of the enrollment growth.
Okay.
I guess one final comment following up on Mr. Bender's thing is, why do we do this? Why are we taking you down this road at all? And there still is statutory requirement that we prepare budgets in a way that we can talk about the kind of adjustments that would be attributable to inflation increases, to phase-in, phase-outs, to caseload increases in agencies that have them. So we are following statutory requirement and building budgets this way, even though we don't look at current service level the way we used to when actually making decisions. It's still a statutory requirement we prepare this kind of information for you.
Well, Mr. McGee, wouldn't you get into this in many cases, maybe not you personally, but some of the budgets we look at are largely general fund, lottery fund dollars. If you go to Human Services, they're general fund, federal. So you're looking at what the appropriate apportionment of costs are, mm-hmm. between those revenue sources. Who's paying for what, basically?
Very much so.
Okay. Any additional questions?
Just one further clarification, Steve. I mean, so the first two things, the 2003-05 legislative approved budget, first column, and the second box there, essential budget level, that's what we're basically talking about, those two items together. And then in context, then you put the next two items together. Would that be a fair assessment of where we're at with that?
The way that Mr. McGee has put this table together, the total represents the sum of the two rows above that.
Yeah.
So we can't combine the reductions in the total. What we are looking at here is a situation where the question of exactly what the reductions are a little bit hard to point down, to clarify exactly, because the essential budget level calculations follow a certain formula. They reflect what the legislature approved last time, and sometimes there are other things that are going on in terms of the revenues that are available from other sources that make it not particularly clear initially what the reduction amounts are. I think that what we see here is a situation where there are clearly some reductions in this budget from what we would expect the costs to be, assuming that the entities had sufficient other funds to carry the same proportion of total costs that they carried or were expected to carry by the legislature in 2003. We have a situation, though, where some of these units will not have sufficient other funds revenues to really maintain that proportion that was approved in 2003, and that's where we're getting additional problems beyond what is shown just here as reductions.
Thank you.
At that point, we probably should get on with the rest of the presentation. And please come forward.
Tuesday, 4.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Assistant Chancellor for Budget and Financial Policy, Oregon University System. What I'm going to cover this morning are the impacts of the changes in the various proposed budget levels for 2005-07. And I'm afraid to say I do have more numbers to show you, and hopefully we'll run through those pretty quickly. First, looking at the governor's recommended budget. The budget doubles the Oregon Opportunity Grant with an increase of $45 million. It moderates tuition increases below the double-digit levels that we've seen over the last two biennia, limiting tuition for resident undergraduates on the average to 7% in year one and 5% in the second year of the biennium. The budget also acknowledges the need to increase faculty salaries with $1 million increase in the budget, and I think you've heard a lot over the last two phases on the level of our faculty salaries and the concerns we have about that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
In the plans on that $1 million, is that going to be spread across to N number of faculty, or is that going to be somehow or another more or less, I hesitate to use the word, but merit-based or critical position-based?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, the plans for using the $1 million are not final. However, it is likely that these funds would be targeted for faculty recruitment and retention. And the reason is that originally we had requested a $30 million increase for faculty salaries to phase over a six-year period up to the trying to get to the average of our competitor universities. And so this is an amount, if spread over all the faculty, would not be enough to make a difference.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, potentially even for recruitment, if you're talking about what would be an average salary on a biennial basis, would be $150,000 to $200,000, wouldn't it, something like that? You'd be recruiting five professors. I mean, that's not a lot of recruitment.
No. Off subject here, but just for the chair, we are going to do an action item at 10:20 for a time specific, and it has nothing to do with the Oregon University System. Is there any member here that will not be here at 10:20?
I could probably be back.
Okay. Well, I think then what we should do is, why don't you, will everyone be here still at 9:30? Why don't we arrange for this?
Okay.
We will take a, you can proceed now, but at 9:30 we will take about a 5 minute.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This budget also implements the Oregon Transfer Module between Oregon's community colleges and university system. It provides funding for the pre-K-20 data transfer system of $2.2 million. It begins to address the backlog of deferred maintenance that is totals now an estimated $600 million. It provides $126 million towards that effort. And it also supports focused research, the ONAMI collaborative research programs at $7 million, and commercialization of intellectual property at $2 million. As
I can I ask a quick question yes. there? Is this fund, the transfer module and data fund issue, is that $2.2 million for both, or is the $2.2 merely for the software/hardware necessary for the data transfer?
Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, the $2.2 million it will cover the complete implementation of the project for the university system. There's also funding in the K-12 budget and in the community college budget.
How much of this is simply for the, if I can follow, Mr. Chair, is simply for the computerized stuff?
All of this funding really is dedicated to creating the system, the software to move the student data from the high schools to the community colleges and university system.
Okay,
excuse me, were you asking specifically how much is goes for the hardware specifically?
Hardware, software, and how much is for what I would call the implementation, the actual doing of it once we've got the hardware, software in place?
Representative Jensen, I would have to bring that information back to you in terms of what is staffing to do the actual implementation and what is actual software. In terms of ongoing costs, we don't expect to. This is a one-time investment, and we expect to be able to cover ongoing costs in future budgets.
Mr. Chair, could I ask for that information?
Yes.
Yes, we will bring that back to you.
I'm sorry for the interruption.
Not at all. This slide is, again, the education and general budget that you were just discussing with Mr. McGee, and shows the changes from the essential budget level, the change from 2003-05 in the governor's recommended budget. And what you see, if you look at the changes from where we are currently today, a 2.4% increase in the budget that will not cover the costs that we have going forward that we're experiencing for the next biennium. I agree with you that the buildup of the essential budget level is very complex, and there's a few people who understand it very well. When we look at the impact on our programs, a fund shift or a real budget cut feel the same at the program level. It is less funding to work with, less funding to cover our cost increases. Moving on to the next slide, this just illustrates the difference between the Senate co-chair's budget as compared to the governor's recommended budget. A 23.3 million increase in general fund, reduction in tuition and fees revenue for a net change of $10.2 million. Available to spend on education and general programs. The House co-chair's budget, very similar at the difference there is $9.6 million. Maybe just summarize the whole issue around the governor's recommended budget in terms of how we see it at the university system and how enrollment growth affects the funds available. What we we see, and this is a slide we looked at yesterday, that compared to 1999-2001, the funding we have in the governor's recommended budget on a per-student basis, if we look at state funds and tuition revenues at $10,423 per student, is about 8.9% less adjusted for inflation than we had in 1999. And basically what it's telling me is that our funding per student has not kept pace with inflation over time. And what this means to us is program cuts and some of the results we've talked about over the last several weeks are and have called warning signals, the kinds of changes that we've seen in the system over time, the lower faculty salaries, the deferred maintenance, and some of the other issues that we've spoken to you about. Moving on to the statewide public service programs, just the same kind of look at these programs. Governor's recommended budget, the change from in funding available from the current levels in 2003-2005, a 3.8% drop overall, a 6.1% reduction from the essential budget level. The Senate co-chair's budget, a partial restoration of $1.3 million to the agricultural experiment station and reduces the drop from 0305 to 2.9% overall. And then in the House budget, a larger restoration of $2.3 million to the Ag Experiment Station, $0.3 million to the Forestry Research Lab, and a net change overall from this biennium of a negative 2%. And then just to summarize the impacts of the co-chair's budget proposals as compared with the governor's recommended budget. The co-chair's budgets improve affordability for all students with a freeze on resident and undergraduate tuition. They reduce the Oregon Opportunity Grant funding for needy students as compared with the governor's proposal. They reduce operating funds for education programs. They eliminate the general funds proposed for the Southern Oregon University Rogue Community College Collaborative effort, the construction project there to support dual enrollment. Reduces capacity in the chancellor's office to support the board's initiatives and accountability efforts. And the co-chair's budget both moderate the reductions to the statewide public service programs. And as Mr. McGee pointed out, none of the budget proposals provide any funding at all for enrollment growth, either in the OUS or in community colleges at this point, or at least the governor's recommended budget. Enrollment is projected in the OUS to increase by 3,760 students in 2005-07. And the additional general funds that we would need, above the cuts that you've spoken about in the education and general budget, to support growth without further harm to our current programs, we've estimated at approximately $15 million. We also wanted to respond to the rankings that the subcommittee presented, the budget priority rankings, and understand very much the difficulty of doing those kinds of rankings and comparing one program to another, because that's a struggle that our board also had to go through in looking at budget priorities. The system generally agreed with the rankings. We acknowledged the difficulty. We did want just to point out where we thought there were differences from the priorities set by our board. And capital construction was rated as a very high priority by the State Board of Higher Education, and I think particularly because of their concern about the deferred maintenance projects. And we very much appreciate that both of the co-chairs' budgets continue to include the funding to address the deferred maintenance projects. And I believe you've also heard from Board President Henry Lorenzen the concern that the board has about the any further reductions to the Chancellor's office, and understand that central services are often ranked below other programs, but that due to these circumstances and the reductions already taken, that this is a concern to the system. That concludes the portion on budget impacts, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions from the committee? I guess I have. Do you have some?
Actually, I do, Senator Nelson. I was wondering how the conclusion was reached to eliminate general funds for the SAU-RCC collaborative construction project.
My understanding is that both of the co-chairs' budgets have eliminated the general fund portion for that project. The governor's budget does include funding both for G bonds and matching general funds. And my understanding is that the entire project has not been eliminated, just the general fund matching portion.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, and I'm not sure you addressed the question. I said, how did that decision come to pass that particular thing was taken out of the budget?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, see if you can answer that.
Yes, if I may comment, that was a co-chair decision, and that was not something that was decided by higher ed. And just to clarify one thing that Ms. Heiligman said, she did say that she was pleased that the co-chairs' budgets maintained the funding for deferred maintenance. And I'm not certain that that is actually the case. They certainly don't cut that funding. But in terms of capital construction, the co-chairs were not specifically looking at the capital projects, and the deferred maintenance projects are capital construction projects. The one exception that they did make in the capital when looking at capital projects was that there are two items in the capital construction budget that are funded by general fund as opposed to being funded by other funds, either gifts or bonds. And the two that were in the governor's budget that were funded by general fund included some funding for deferred maintenance, not all of it, and also a $5.4 million contribution toward the new facility in Medford that Southern would like to build with Rogue Community College. When they looked at that, they did take out the general fund component for the new building, though they maintained the general fund that was in the governor's budget for the deferred maintenance issues. And I believe that their reasoning for doing that was prioritization of the use of general funds, and that general funds are typically not provided for capital construction projects and higher ed and community colleges. This was the only request for general fund for a capital construction project. And I believe that they did not feel that in this budget environment they were able to supply capital general fund directly for a capital construction project.
For the record, I'd like to be very clear that the Oregon University system very much supports restoration of the $5.4 million for the Southern Oregon facility.
Thank you.
On pay or on slide 11, you talk about additional general funds needed to support growth without harm to current programs is $15 million, the last item. Is that, you're talking about enrollment growth?
Senator Nelson, yes, that's correct. That that would not restore the cuts that you've seen to the education and general program, but $15 million is the amount we think that we are short in terms of enrolling additional students.
And then yesterday, you heard the testimony from Dr. Ray that about the priorities of for student funding. He actually put the tuition freeze at the very bottom, and he went to Oregon Opportunity, and finally the enrollment growth was his most important. Do you have any comment on that? Or?
Senator Nelson, our board has not met and established their priorities, but I do believe that there is a consensus among staff in the system that those would be the priorities of the system.
What I'm hearing from, I guess, the student groups basically is they like the governor's budget better than they like the co-chair's budget. And then there's other portions that they like the co-chair's, but other interest groups like the co-chair's budget better than the governor's budget. So that's just trying to figure out where we're all sitting with this.
Senator Nelson, I think the a lack of support over the last several biennia for enrollment growth in the system at a time when we've been growing very rapidly is seen as a major problem. And if you look at, compare the number of students that we were serving in 1999, we looked at that graph a few minutes ago, compared with 2005-2007, there is growth of nearly 14,000 students during that time, and we're not receiving funding for those students.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
That concluded the portion on the budget impacts, and we did want to comment very briefly on our legislative concepts. We have for OUS introduced, now we have one bill, House Bill 2104, which is really a housekeeping amendment with no fiscal impact. This is for the optional retirement plan that is part of the benefits provided by the Oregon University system to unclassified employees as an alternative to the PERS system. And these are basically, as I said, technical adjustments to recognize the changes that have been implemented in PERS legislation over the last several years. And that bill was passed out of the House Labor, Business, and Consumer Affairs Committee and is currently in the Senate Rules Committee. Is at this time our only legislative concept, and again, it has no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Bender?
Yeah.
Yes.
At this point, I'm going to close the hearings. I'm going to close the hearings on 5513, 5514. We will reopen them shortly and open a work session on Health Bill 5047.
Oh, we've seen this bill before, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we have.
I need to get consent.
There we go. State Library.
Okay. If we'll be at ease for just a moment. Okay.
Thank you. Oh, there's red stuff on his face.
Well, here. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow a motion to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 5047 was reported out of the full committee. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, the chair will accept a motion to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 5047 was reported out to the full committee.
I would so move, Mr. Chair, as penance.
Yeah, the chair is doing penance.
20 lashes in the woodshed.
Okay. It has been moved to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 5047 was reported out to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing no objections, the motion carries and the bill will be back before the subcommittee. Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I don't think any of you are surprised at this point, but let me introduce the item to you. When you met on April 27th, there was an amendment to the recommendation before you to reinstate a portion of the general fund reductions that were taken due to PERS and Attorney General rate reductions. The adjustment was intended to cover facilities rent for talking book and braille services. The co-chairs have asked that you reconsider that. So I guess the original recommendation from LFO is back before you for reconsideration. I would note for you that the discussion around the rent was that the state government service charge had been backfilling a portion of their rent. There is limitation in this recommendation for them to collect other fees or services as long as it's not the state assessment money to cover the rent. I think the agency indicated at the time that they would have to work with their constituent base to get through that, but it is LFO's belief, as well as DAS budget and management, that they will be able to accomplish this. If not, returning to the e-board for additional resources is always an option.
Okay. Is there a motion to accept the original LFO recommendation?
So moved.
So moved. It has been moved. Before that recommendation, just to reiterate one thing that Ms. Brown indicated, our direction before to look at existing donations, look at additional donations, potentially come to the e-board if they do have a problem is still on the record. And also they do receive a substantial amount of general funds in total for this program, and if they can somehow realign their efforts of how they do the program, they may be able to do it in that way also, in terms of utilizing their general funds in a slightly different way. But there is a motion on the floor to accept the original LFO recommendations. We will call the roll.
Representative
March.
Aye.
Representative Lindner.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Senator
Whitsett.
Aye.
Chair
Devlin.
Aye. And Senator Gordley is excused. Motion passes, and we will keep our original carriers, Representative Whitsett. Who is the original carrier?
March.
Representative March. And
he's the one who got us into trouble.
Representative March and Senator Gordley, and I'll talk to Senator Gordley. Although we do not know if these are going to the full committee or what happens to this bill after this point, but the bill has passed. Okay, the bill passed. I will close the work session, and I will reopen a work session on Senate Bill 5513 and 5514. Or, I'm sorry. Clarification. The chair has reopened I don't want anybody to get anxious. The chair has reopened a hearing on 5513, 5514. The co-chairs heard I'd opened work sessions. I'm told they would both be down here.
You have to go to the woodshed? Okay.
Okay.
Capital construction.
Please proceed. Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the subcommittee. I'm Bob Simonton, Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. In phase one of our presentation, we gave you an overview of the entire 2005-07 capital budget request. And today I'm here to follow up and answer any questions you may have about those presentations, and also want to follow up and answer and revisit several items. Wrong way. There we go. I have two slides. The first looks at jobs. In earlier testimony, I mentioned that 3,200 jobs would be created as a result of this budget. However, I want to clarify that the jobs will be spread over several biennia, and there are several reasons for this. Many of the projects need to complete their design documents, which will take some time. And secondly, the projects that require state G bonds must have their fundraising completed in order to comply with the constitutional matching requirement. Now, we also wait until the end of the biennium to sell the G bonds because the general funds to repay the debt service are not appropriated until the following biennium. So I have a handout which highlights all of the state bond-funded projects, which will be impacted by the bond sale schedule. And the graph currently shown here reflects how some of the jobs are pushed into the next biennium as a result. I also want to mention again about Southern's Medford project, with the general fund portion being removed from that project, it will delay the project for many years because the fundraising capability of the regional schools is simply not there. So that's another thing to consider on that project.
Chair?
Yes.
I'd asked a question of LFO staff here, and it's my understanding that we could use lottery funds for that if there are some available.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, we have done that in the past. We have used lottery funds as a match for the G bonds. We've also used general funds. Since 95, we've had five projects that have used general funds as the match for the G bonds.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Chair Dillon, Mr. Simonton, could you expand a little bit on why that project is not, the local people are unable to raise those funds and have requested general funds? I mean, is there something about bonding that they're unable to do? Is there, I mean, could you clarify why that is?
Yes, Chair Dillon, Senator Whitsitt. At Southern, there's been several recent projects that have tapped the Southern's Foundation, and we've had the Center for the Visual Arts, their library project. So to go back to the well again for another $5.4 million is probably very unlikely. Southern administration has approached the foundation, and they've committed to $500,000 of the match, which is far short of the $5.4 million. We've explored every possible grant funding opportunity, Oregon Energy Trust, but we could probably only piece together, you know, $250,000 here. We're looking at the donation of the land to the project, but unfortunately we can't consider that as a general fund match. We need some form of cash in order to make that match happen. So there are very many challenges to raise that amount of money in that project.
There's also the obvious situation in the sense that it's a joint project. The Rogue Community College, which is actually a different budget than what we have before us, but they have their match. The voters have approved their match. Obviously, the university system does not have the ability, and no one is suggesting that they should have the ability to go to the voters to approve a match. but I think it's generally, we've seen this in previous sessions where regionals have come in and had projects, but have had difficulty raising the local dollars. Simply not having the same base of donors as an OSU or U of O or a PSU. That's been difficult for them. In fact, some of us suggested perhaps we should change the formula for the regionals and make it maybe a one-third, two-thirds would be a fairer formula for them than the one-half, one-half.
Sure, Dillon.
Yes.
If I could follow up on that a little. Do you have an appraised value of the land that would be donated?
Senator Dillon, Chair, or Senator Wislet, the value of the land is approximately $600,000 for the property that is being considered to be donated.
So even if you were to consider that a donation, we'd still be about 4.5 short. Yeah.
correct.
There is still an outstanding question, Senator Whitsitt, and isn't there in terms of about $1.8 million coming from the Urban Renewal District potentially? There's been some discussion that the Urban Renewal District would contribute to the project, and that could be considered part of the local match.
Yes, that's correct. We're looking at every opportunity, every avenue to come up with this match. But in the end, I think we would fall somewhere short, and hopefully the opportunity to work with you to figure out the final funding solution for the project.
Is there anything additional, Senator Wilson?
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
Now, the next slide also is a longer-term view. We've tried for many years to get funding in place to resolve our staggering deferred maintenance problem. The funding of Tiers 1 and 2, which are shown in this handout, plus the OSU energy plant, is an important first step in the process that will take six biennia to resolve. So with the continued funding, my vision is that by the year 2020, we will have completed the renewal of 136 buildings, buildings that have major components in them that are worn out and need replaced. And it will also take that long to renew those buildings. You can't take 136 buildings offline at one time. Let's see here. And also in the handout, the projects are listed for Tiers 1 and 2, plus the remaining tiers that would have been requested for 05-07.
Can you go into a little detail on the tier, which are not in the governor's recommendation at this point, the Tier 3 projects both at the U of O, PSU, and Eastern Oregon?
Certainly, Chair Devlin. Let's see, the first one is the U of O's Fenton Hall. That's a 1905 building. I believe that was their first library. It's now occupied by the Department of Mathematics. If you look at the total renewal cost, it actually exceeds what the current replacement value is when we add the seismic components to it. In 1905, there was no indication of any kind of seismic activity in Oregon, so the building was not designed or built to withstand what we now know is the Cascadia subduction zone threat. PSU Lincoln Hall, that building was actually constructed in 1911. That was a high school, Portland's Lincoln High School, and they decided that they were going to condemn and demolish the building back in 1949 when it was worn out then, but instead decided to donate it to Portland State University. So in 1953, that became Portland State's first building and became actually their entire campus at their present location. It's now used by the performing arts. It's an unreinforced masonry structure, which is not typically perform very well in seismic events. There's not many good things I can say about the subsystems within the building. They all are failing and way beyond their useful life. And also that building is very close to its current replacement value as far as the needs to renew that structure. Eastern's Inlow Hall, that building was constructed in 1930. Not as many problems as far as renewal costs, but what brought that building up to Tier 3 relates to its history. In 1927, the city of LeGrand donated the land to the state to build Eastern Oregon's Normal School. Unfortunately, the land they donated to us was an old cemetery, and the project was supposedly to remove all of the bodies to another cemetery. Unfortunately, that did not happen. So part of the project in this Tier 3 project is to deal with that issue. There are remaining bodies underneath the building, the administration building.
Oh.
That's an Eastern.
Some are in the building, too.
That's the difference. So I typically say that the founding fathers of Le Grand are the foundation of this university. So that's why that project is raised up to tier three.
You know, in Europe, they build entire cities over old cities and bodies, so I guess we're not quite different, but that's, oh, my.
Okay.
Is it haunted, Mr. Chair? Is the building haunted?
Senator Walker, I don't believe it's haunted. I've been in the crawl space and actually viewed the bodies.
Do they have a paranormal study program at Eastern Oregon?
I just watched the movie Poltergeist before I went under there.
I think it is haunted.
It has to be. Maybe they like the company. I don't know. But that's fascinating. That is a fascinating piece of Oregon history. Thank you for sharing it.
Please,
that's all I have.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Devlin?
Yes.
If I might, I had a conversation with President Von Meyer this morning in the office, and one of the things that I had asked them, and I would ask of you, in those capital projects, not the maintenance, but in the building projects, if we could have some estimation of the cost savings, potential cost savings by being able to move the current education effort into one area, and perhaps reducing FTEs, reducing equipment, that type of thing. And also on the other end of it, the impact of the being able to educate more individuals who and their potential impact on the revenue. And what I'm asking here is to try to get a little quantification of how the revenue stream picture might be improved in order to enable us to pay back those bonds.
Okay. Well, thank you. Follow up on that.
Okay. Ms. Weeks. Yes.
Yes. We have the debt service that will be required
on the new project.
Yeah, on tier 1-5 through 5.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't bring those with me.
We'll try to bring those next week, if possible.
That's fine.
But the other thing is that there is still the outstanding question, at least the formal outstanding. There's other questions, but the governor has added in a couple of additional projects beyond his original budget, which are projects where the local match is now either is in place or should be shortly in place. So we might have to look at two different debt service numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Weeks, Deputy for Planning, Oregon University System. I'm very pleased to come back to you to talk about performance measures and follow up on several of the requests that you had from Phase 1. What I'm hoping to cover in just the brief time is, before we launch into those specific requests from the subcommittee, to talk briefly about characteristics of a performance indicator. The subject arose through some of the conversations I had, follow-up conversations with some of you and with Mr. Bender, and I think it might be helpful just to clarify what we're looking at in terms of how we construct a performance indicator. We'll review the measures that you have requested, briefly review some of the co-chair suggestions and the process for that. Talk a bit about other accountability reporting, and I mean very briefly, but just to set some context for this, and then finally revisit our framework, which you should have in front of you, which is our work in progress, the OUS Performance and Accountability Framework. Let me make just a couple of comments about performance indicators. Generally, in constructing a performance indicator, we look for three things. One is that it measures a high-level outcome. Two, that the results and consequences of that measure are actually things that the agency or result of agency activities or policies, and number three, that, and this may be the most important one, that the measure allows for target setting. And so we've been guided by those three principles as we've been considering ours, even in our new framework. Not every indicator meets all three of those principles, but our goal is that each one should, to the extent possible. As we look at your specific request, the first one that I'd like to address is the effectiveness of partnerships with Oregon community colleges. And I believe in one of the hearings this question was raised, and this is something that is of obviously vital importance to us as the board proceeds with its initiatives with the community colleges. What we would recommend as measures actually are, two of them are measures that we currently have in our performance measure set. And these, all three of these, we believe are outcome-focused. They and should show the effectiveness of those partnerships on student access and student progress. The first one, which we currently have in our set, the enrollment of new community college transfers. The second one, graduation rates for community college transfers that we also currently report. And then we would propose a new measure, which would be the time to degree for community college transfers. How long does it take for them to graduate once they come to OUS? We believe those three together would provide some strong outcome measures for those partnerships. But having said that, I would also,
Oh, yes, Representative Jim. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're looking at these measures and the graduation rate and time to degree, I think there's a variable in here that probably needs to be considered. And while it's true in some of the students entering community colleges and graduating are among the brightest and best in the state, the general norm would be that many of them, generally I think we can say that many of them enter the process somewhat below where the university students would enter in terms of their academic preparation, etc., sort of thing. And before we place too much credibility in some of the numbers on this, on the out-of-year performance measures here, I would hope that we would find some way to factor in the basic difference that appears in the community college students versus the typical student entering the university. And I say this with a lot of fondness, as most of you are aware, as far as the community colleges are concerned, but I think it needs to be tempered with some reality. My fondness needs to be tempered with some, as I think just a kind of base figures we're looking at need to be on that. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think that's a very important point to make, and we do, as part of our ongoing activity, collect a vast array of data about students. It's not all, obviously, does not become a performance measure. We report it in many other ways, and we do lots of studies. And we do have data that we like to use, particularly as we track these initiatives with the community colleges, to look at the academic, both the academic performance and the qualifications of students coming into our system. So, yes, we'd be very interested in pursuing that.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Devon, thank you, Ms. Weeks. Just to quantify what the good representative was saying, within the Klamath Community College, 20% of the students who present themselves for the first time to the community college are unable to do basic 8th grade English, and 80% are unable to do basic 8th grade math. So those are often those people who have dropped out of school, who have done poorly in high school, are greatly overrepresented in the community college community, whereas those who have excelled in the high school situation are those who generally present themselves to universities. Thank you.
Before I leave this particular measure, I do want to say, too, that we are committed to working with the next biennial community college partners to further develop and refine these measures. These are the three that we can propose right now, but we're very open to other ways to look at this. It's a very critical performance area for us and for the community colleges, and so we're committed to that.
I had one question, and I'm not asking for another report. I'll just put the question on the table. Graduation rate for community college transfers, time to degree for community college transfers. If we had a large portion of community college transfers that were taking the block of courses that I understand there's agreement now can transfer directly into the university system, then those numbers should be relatively good in the end. If we still have a lot of transfers that are not taking those prerequisite courses or those normal courses you take in the first 2 years, then those numbers probably would not be as good because they would have to be doing those in their third year, fourth year of college. Do we have any idea, is our pattern for transfers of community college students changing? Are they taking more things that will just directly fit into the program, or is there a relatively, since I don't even have baseline data to even base this on, but has there been any change in terms of what they're taking, or are most students that transfer, are they able to transfer most of their courses into either meeting, having most of their courses accepted and meeting many of their prerequisites for upper division courses, or what has been the recent history in that? So I think there's been a lot of emphasis, at least I've heard it, about developing a core group of courses that you can transfer onto the university system without question that should prepare you for entering. That's a difficult question, I know. But
Senator Devlin, that is many questions.
Yes.
And there are many, many excellent questions. And I humbly ask not to have to answer that right now, but to take that back, and we will provide an answer to you about that.
Okay. The short answer would be fine. Representative Jensen.
You raised, and as we're talking about this and thought or concept is for me, I know the university system has a lot of students transferring in that are not from community colleges. They're transferring from other universities, large and small, as it might be. I wonder if we have any way to compare and contrast community college students transferring in versus the other university students transferring in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, compare and contrast in what regard do you?
Well, in your performance measures, in relationship to the graduation rate, then at the university, in relationship to the time to degree, the student transferring in from the University of Utah, as an example, compared and contrasted to the community college student transferring in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, we do have the capacity to look at to break apart the different populations of students and look at that. And I'm hoping I'm not driving our research staff crazy by committing to that, mm-hmm. but I do believe we have the capacity to look at that, and
well,
we can follow up.
And I see a couple of presidents in the room, so they can shoot me when we go out in the hall if I'm asking.
The second set of measures, or the second measure that you requested and that we would be adding to our set, would be one on faculty diversity. And what we would recommend is to track the number and percent of regular rank faculty who are faculty of color. We currently do track that now. We report on that in other vehicles, not in our performance measurement reporting, but we do report on this as part of the annual diversity report. We report on it in our fact book and other areas. And so this is something we do have the data capacity to do already and are already reporting. The difference is that we have not yet set targets for this, and that is something we'll need to discuss with our provosts and campuses about the target setting for this indicator.
I should note, too, that Senator Nelson and Senator Whitsitt both had to leave for a Senate Republican caucus meeting, so they didn't leave for any reason.
Anything I said. Thank you. Then there are two sets of shortage area degree measures, one related to teacher shortage and the other to the health care. Senator Gordley had raised the issue of teacher shortage areas in specific areas that we do not track in detail right now, but we would propose, and those she mentioned, and we concur, these are shortage areas, are foreign language, special education, and math. And we have several recommendations for these measures. First, that we can report the degrees awarded in those specialty areas, and so we can report those. But we think it's important to also engage the Department of Education, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and the Employment Department, along with our Deans of Education and campuses, in a more robust study of teacher shortage areas. For example, in the math education area, having one statewide indicator is probably not going to tell you a whole lot, because the distribution of shortage is uneven in different areas of the state. And so it will be important to have something a bit more detailed and comprehensive to address that. And I know that Yvette Weber-Davis in the Chancellor's Office, who is working in this area, as well as other colleagues in other agencies, do intend to work collaboratively on something that would provide, I think, more robust data than simply that indicator. But we can at least track, and these degrees awarded will connect to that kind of a study. And then finally, what arose in some of our conversations in the last few weeks as we've considered these shortage areas is the broader question of how do you identify and how do you then sunset a shortage area out of your performance set? The goal, obviously, is to take action that will make it not a shortage area anymore, to the extent that we have control over that. But our concern has been to make sure we have performance measures that are enduring, that one can look at over a long period of time, at least 10 years, if not longer. And so that we need to somehow develop a policy for how we review when something is a shortage area and when it no longer is, and it needs to then go away and be replaced by something that is. The other related area for degrees would be in nursing and other healthcare staffing shortage areas, and this is something that is a very high priority. We know for the state, it is for the board. The board's working group in academic excellence and economic development is looking at this area. There is a subcommittee that is chaired by President Martha Ann Dow from OIT, working with the governor's office, working with the community colleges, with the nursing education consortium, with OHSU, to look at this in a very focused way. And so we are certainly want our performance measures to be right in line with that. What we would propose is to show the OUS degrees awarded in allied health, which are primarily up from OIT, and then also the number of nursing degrees awarded to nursing students who are enrolled in our three universities that work with OHSU in providing nursing education. We recognize, though, that addressing this shortage area is not just a function of OUS, it's also a function of the community colleges, and there are private universities as well who provide nursing education. And so I would just raise that point that it will not address solely the shortage area without probably also in some fashion looking as a state at those other providers. Then I would also without taking a lot of time to go through this, I want to alert you to this other handout, which is proposed OUS performance measures for 2005-07. It's rather lengthy. It's a table that shows what we would propose as the set that we would come back and report to you on through this coming biennium. It includes the current measures that we report, some proposed new measures, both ones that we have proposed and measures that you have proposed. And it also addresses the list of suggested measures and area of measurement concern from the co-chairs and vice co-chairs. And those are included, as you can see on this table, there are boxes with check marks to indicate what the source of the request or the change is. I won't go through this. It's very lengthy, but I will say that there are comments that should provide some sense of what the challenges might be in making some of these changes. There are some differences in what we believe we can report versus target. That's, I think, the key thing. There are things that we can generally report without too much difficulty. There are a couple where we don't think we could, but there are some that we could report, but we would not necessarily think they'd be appropriate for target setting. And there is some further detail. The last two pages have some more detailed explanatory notes regarding those. These are we have obviously reviewed your requests, and we need now to review in more detail with the co-chairs and vice co-chairs what the nature of their requests and suggestions are a little bit more. And we would be happy. We plan to do that. We'd be happy to then report back to you in phase three about that.
Yeah. I think that would be actually very good, but we do not know what phase three is right now,
well,
or how many different groups will be going through phase three.
Mr. Chair, I understand, and I guess I use the term advisedly. but in any case, we can report back.
And in all cases, we'll be working with Mr. Bender on that.
Yes, indeed. We will. I wanted to briefly mention that while we have a very active and, I think, rigorous performance measurement program, we also have a broader accountability function, and I want to draw your attention to that. Many of the measures that may be suggested are in some ways better reported through other sources. For example, we spoke with Representative Jensen about things like pass rates on certification exams, which while is useful and very valuable information to report, it may not be appropriate for a performance measure, but we do we have committed to reporting that, and we do have our fact book. And if you have not seen this or received it, we will make sure you have a copy. This is something that we use. It's been published biennially for the last 20 years, and it contains a lot of information and data where we can track a predictable set of data on every aspect of higher education. And we will include now some additional, including the pass rates on certification exams in the future, in the next fact book. But that is a source that allows us to report and track. It is not, it doesn't set targets, but it does provide you some very robust and comprehensive information. We obviously have our annual and quarterly financial statements, the annual diversity report, various retention and graduation reports, lots of studies, student profiles, academic performance, loads of data and studies that we do to be accountable to you and to the public. And so I just wanted to put that into context. It's not just through performance measurement, but you do have other vehicles available to you to monitor and track what we do in higher education. And then finally, I'll refer back once again to the graph that you have in front of you. We are working with our board now as they work on the long-range planning activity, and the performance measures, and these are still, in fact, the handout you have says draft. This is still a work in progress. As we're working through it, we want to be very sure that our measures connect very clearly to the long-range planning and the plans that emerge from the board's initiatives and activities in that area. So we will be working closely with them to make sure these are right in line with their long-range planning. I will stop at this point, and if there are other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Ms. Gates? Yes, Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The on your performance and accountability framework under the education quality, teacher effectiveness, have you worked? Do you have any models, or how are you, you know, is there standards? And, you know, you have students per part-time faculty and percentage of part-time faculty. You know, if we're realistic, I can understand the university system wanting to have as many full-time and highly qualified teachers as possible. But that's a cost driver. And as our society changes, we have people that want to work part-time. Is there any hope that university scoring systems or whoever there rates universities will ever, you know, lower that or be more realistic and help us where we can have more part-time instructors helping cut down our cost and hold down our cost? And, again, any comments on, you know, what's out there to measure teacher effectiveness? And I'm sorry, I just don't, you know, believe seniority always equals teacher effectiveness.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, excellent questions. The teaching effectiveness, and I should say on this framework, you'll see that there are some measures in italics. Those are things that are either, they're not in our current set of performance measures. They're either new ones that for which we do have data or new ones for which we don't. That's in the latter category. We don't yet. We know that's an important, conceptually, that's an important area to try to get a handle on. And I will say that we, the provosts, are very committed to looking at that in a focused way, but we don't have good answers on that right now. We don't have good measures. We will try our best to develop them, but you are absolutely right. It is a difficult thing to measure, and it's not just something like seniority. We're looking in something a bit, I hope, more hard-headed than that, and so we will be doing that as part of our review and development over the next 2 years. With regard to the part-time faculty, it's always a tough balance between being most efficient and cost-effective and making best use of the resources, and at the same time providing for a very high-quality student experience. And the issue is not the quality of part-time faculty. We have excellent part-time faculty. It's that there's nothing wrong with part-time faculty. The problem is that when you have a declining proportion of full-time faculty, you have less capacity to provide for the out-of-classroom experiences that are integral to a university. The student advising, the mentoring, the meeting with students on projects, the thesis guidance, all of those things are part of what a full-time faculty member who's a regular part of the department provides. The part-time faculty do not provide that. And so when you lose the full-time faculty, that advising load and all that is loaded onto smaller and smaller numbers of full-time faculty, and they simply cannot provide that same quality of experience and the interaction with students when they are fewer in number. This also has a relationship to how well students can persist and be retained and complete in a timely fashion. There is evidence that the closer that students can connect to their faculty and have those kinds of good instructional relationships with their faculty, the more likely they are to stay in school. And it reinforces and enhances our ability to improve our persistence and retention if we have a critical mass of full-time faculty. So that is the reason for our concern about the declining numbers of full-time faculty. It's not that the part-time faculty are not qualified people. They are. It's what it does to the overall quality of the student experience.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It's good comments. But the other question I had, are you forced or do you try to have full-time because of rating systems by, you know, these people that rate universities, the number of full-time, the number of PhDs versus masters? Is that, you know, isn't that some of the factors that force you or drive you towards full-time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I have not heard that that is what guides the university's concern for having more full-time faculty. I think it is strictly the quality of student experience and understanding what will help students get through quickly, get through it with the kind of rich environment and level of instruction they deserve to have. I haven't heard reference to concern about what it does to reputational rankings and that sort of thing.
Representative March.
I just wanted to comment on the teaching effectiveness. I know as both having been a student and a professor adjunct at Portland State, they have a rating system within the College of Urban and Public Affairs, for example, where the teachers are rated by the students on a variety of things, including effectiveness, appropriateness of materials, etc. And I'm pretty confident that other universities in the system have a similar thing. It's a question, can we take some of that data and use it as part of a measurement? And that's a mm-hmm. tougher question. I'm sure it's a standardizing and equalizing some of that data. But I know it's used for determining who stays around, who gets invited back, things yeah. like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, yes, in fact, you're echoing exactly the initial conversations we've had with the Provost Council about how to approach this. And you're right, every campus has teaching evaluations, and they aren't all the same, and so the issue of standardizing is a question. But we've started those conversations, and so very good point.
Thank you.
Pursue that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to also compliment you for the response about the correspondent courses and everything, and the members of the committee might want to note that there is no limit on how many correspondence or online courses you can take, and the numbers are pretty impressive of course availability and enrollments. So.
Please proceed.
That's end of my comment.
Nothing additional? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chancellor, you're going to wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try to do so quickly. Again, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor of Oregon University System. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee for your patience over the last, I kind of figured it's something like 18 hours of our testimony here over the last couple of months, and I appreciate your patience and your forbearance, your questions and your interest. And I appreciate, too, all of the presentations which our board members, which volunteers, which presidents, faculty, students, staff, and others have made to you, because I hope that they have helped you understand better the university system and what it can mean for the state. We started out this discussion by talking about some of the real high points, I think, in terms of the Oregon University system. The fact that our graduation rates are up 4-year, 5-year, 6-year, I don't care which rate you use, it's better than it used to be. Our enrollment is up. Our research is up. Our donations are up. All of those traditional measures of higher education, in fact, are better today than they have been in many years. At the same time, though, we've talked about the warning signs. We've talked about, as Representative Wisnett just mentioned again, the fact that we have fewer regular faculty today than we did 10 years ago, even though we have 20,000 students more today than we did 10 years ago. And there are impacts of that on advising and on a whole variety of other matters that we are concerned about. We are concerned, too, about the deferred maintenance backlog, which I think you've heard about earlier. We are concerned about lower support for students, less advising, less student services, a whole variety of things that over the years have been attenuated by budget cuts. But really what we are looking at this budget as being is the start of a discussion about the future, a future for a prosperous state whose economy is fueled by a highly educated workforce. Something that will demand that we raise the sights and expectations of all Oregonians. Something that will demand that we view higher education as an investment that will have a social and economic payoff in the future. Not tomorrow, not day after tomorrow, but 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, even 40 years out. That's really been the message that we've talked about over the last 18 hours. We're focusing in the future and in the present with our board, our presidents, our faculty, our staff, and our students on a few very basic things. And they boil down, in my mind, to two things only: student success and state success. And if you look at student success, we are focusing more and more on moving students through to degree as effectively and efficiently as we can. You've heard about the seamless transfer of students. You've heard about the Oregon Transfer Module. We've talked about various kinds of ways to accelerate time to degree without sacrificing quality. We're talking in the next biennium about trying to figure out how to standardize more how we view advanced placement courses. We don't now really all count them the same way. So things like that will help students understand better what it will take to get a degree and better how they, in fact, can navigate the system. And the Atlas system, which we've talked about for allowing people to basically self-advise in some ways, is also there. We're focusing also on state success, economic development, and excellence. Trying to find, in the next biennium, our board committee will be trying to find a few economic development initiatives that will provide measurable returns on investment, touch every part of this state, build on our momentum, build on our excellence in faculty. Things like ONAMI, ETIC, the intellectual property commercialization that you see in the current budget, we are continuing to look for those, and our board will continue to look for those as we move forward. Another focus on student success really boils down to affordability. Access and affordability are fundamental to an educated citizenry in a state like Oregon. We support, as Mr. McGee has mentioned, as others have mentioned, the increase in the Oregon Opportunity Grant that's in the governor's recommended budget. We support the tuition moderation efforts that are in the governor's recommended budget and the fee remission changes that are there. But the focus here, again, is on helping students to be able to afford to go to college, helping students to be able to have the kind of future that we believe they and the state will want. In the next biennium, Board President Lorenzen talked about, we will be working with the other educational segments to try to figure out a much more collaborative and seamless and aligned approach to pre-K-20 education. Within whatever resources are available to us, we will attempt to do that. What we're trying to do here, though, is to focus on the needs of Oregonians, rural and urban, whether or not they have money or not, focusing then on the state and on the success of the state and the students, but looking at it in ways we have not done before, looking at it in ways that involve our partners in the community colleges, our partners throughout the K-12 system, much more collaboratively with us than we have been wont to do in the past. And that's an effort that our board is committed to move forward. The focus on the future that I have talked about boils down to access, affordability, excellence, economic development. Those are the four themes that we have hammered over and over during these 18 hours. In religious traditions with which I am familiar, there are certain things that are called chants. And it's almost become a chant for me to say access, affordability, excellence, and economic development, because it's a way of remembering the four main themes of our budget. In terms of access, we're looking at efficiency, the transfer module, other manners of improving the way to get students through to degree. We're looking at working with pre-K through 20. We're looking also at enrollment growth. As Ms. Heiligman indicated, enrollment growth has occurred since 1999, 14,000 students. There has not been funding for that growth from the state. So that as we move forward, as we look at the social compact between the state and its citizens, one of the things that we are concerned about is for the next wave of enrollment growth over the next 10 years, can we in fact begin to have the kinds of funding for that growth that would allow us to at least maintain the quality which we have developed? Another access issue is deferred maintenance. I had the opportunity over the weekend to go into the building on the OSU campus, the education building, which has all the chain link fence around it to hold on the exterior. Because I hadn't been in that building in many years, I hadn't been in that building in probably 25 years. It hasn't changed on the inside. The only thing that's changed is the outside, where it's beginning to fall. It is important for us to deal with the major buildings which have served us well for 100 years, and to make sure that they'll be here and serving us well for the next 100. So access deals with our ability to enroll students, our ability to fund those students, our ability to have buildings that will serve them, our ability to work with our educational partners in K-12 and community colleges. All those things are key. Affordability is key. We've talked about the Opportunity Grant, about tuition moderation, about fee remissions. We've spoken about academic excellence in terms of faculty salaries, knowing that we're to the point now where our faculty are valued as much around the country that we bring in nearly as much money from the federal government as we get from the state. That makes them very hot commodities. We want to maintain and retain and attract people at least as good as we move into the future. And economic development, we've talked there about ONAMI, about ETIC, about intellectual property. But all of those things really, while they are important, and they are, we have to know where we're going, and we have to know, are we getting there? Hence the focus on performance measures. Hence the focus on targets. Our major target, as we brought to you in the return on investment discussion, is in fact the number of degrees. The number of degrees becomes a surrogate for us, for our success internally, and for the likely success that we believe the state will have in social and economic development in 20 years or 30 years or 10 years or 40 years. Are we getting there? The framework which Ms. Weeks provided you helps us organize our thinking, helps us organize our programs, helps us organize our efforts in order to make sure that we are moving forward to try to meet the number of degrees that we believe Oregon will need. Again, access, affordability, excellence, economic development. We believe that the success of Oregon's future and that of Oregonians demands that we keep this focus, that we keep it for many years, and that we get it right. And we're, with your help, we are convinced that we will do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There are no questions. Ms. Chancellor, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for all your staff being here. Thank everybody for being in the audience, and particularly the university presidents that are here that have sat through all of this testimony today. And with that, I will close the public hearings on 5513 and 5514, and we will close this hearing.
Thank you very much.